All right, the first article is out of the New American Magazine. Global temperature is dropping, not rising. Environmental doomsayers may still be claiming that we must radically reduce carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions in order to prevent catastrophic global warming. But they cling to that position despite the fact that the warming they've been forecasting has not occurred. In fact, the average global temperature has gone down, not up, in recent years. The divergence between IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the divergence between the IPCC temperature predictions and the actual temperature record was graphically illustrated in a March 16th internal report by EPA research analyst Alan Carlin, entitled Comments on Draft Technical Support Document for Endangerment Analysis for Greenhouse Gas Emissions Under the Clean Air Act. And if you can pronounce that in all one sentence, you're better than I am. His very telling graph, and page 4 of the report, it's reproduced here. So here it is. I hope you can see it. As Carlin explains on the page following the graph, okay, we can't get into that. The EPA document also notes that the actual data conflicts with the theory that CO2 causes temperature to rise. Quote, what's really rather remarkable is that since 2000, the rates at which CO2 emissions and concentrations are increasing has accelerated. And yet, despite accelerating emission rates and concentrations, there's been net warming in the 21st century, and more accurately, a decline. In the preface of his report, Carlin opined that his concerns and reservations are sufficiently important to warrant a serious review of the science by EPA before any attempt is made to reach conclusions on the subject of endangerment from greenhouse gases. But the concerns raised by Carlin are not the concerns of the Obama administration once raised. All right, the next article is dedicated to all of you fans of our beloved ex-king, George W. Bush. It's called A French Revelation or The Burning Bush. It's by James A. Hout. He's the editor of the Charleston Gazette in West Virginia, and he's a Free Inquiry senior editor. So this is from Free Inquiry. Incredibly, President George W. Bush told French President Jacques Chirac in early 2003 that Iraq must be invaded to thwart Gog and Magog, the Bible's satanic agents of the apocalypse. Honest, this is not a joke. The President of the United States, in a top-secret phone call to a major European ally, asked for French troops to join American soldiers in attacking Iraq on a mission from God. Now out of office, Chirac recounts that the American leader appealed to their common faith, Christianity, and told him, quote, Gog and Magog are at work in the Middle East. The biblical prophecies are being fulfilled. This confrontation is willed by God, who wants to use this conflict to erase his people's enemies before a new age begins. Close quote. This bizarre episode occurred while the White House was assembling its coalition of the willing to unleash the Iraqi invasion. Chirac says he was boggled by Bush's call and wondered how someone could be so superficial and fanatical in their beliefs. After the 2003 call, the puzzled French leader didn't comply with Bush's request. Instead, his staff asked Thomas Romer, a theologian at the University of Lausanne, to analyze the weird appeal. Dr. Romer explained that the Old Testament book of Ezekiel contains two chapters in which God rages against Gog and Magog, sinister and mysterious forces menacing Israel. Jehovah vows to smite them savagely, to, quote, turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, close quote, and slaughter them ruthlessly. In the New Testament, the mystical book of Revelation envisions Gog and Magog gathering nations for battle, quote, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them, close quote. In 2007, Dr. Romer recounted Bush's strange behavior in Lausanne University's review, Allez Savoir. A French-language Swiss newspaper, Le Matin Dimanche, printed a sarcastic account titled, quote, When President George W. Bush Saw the Prophecies of God Coming to Pass, close quote. France's La Liberté likewise spoofed it under the headline, A Small Scoop on Bush, Chirac, God, Gog, and Magog. But other news media missed this amazing report. Subsequently, ex-President Chirac confirmed the nutty event in a long interview with French journalist Jean-Claude Maurice, who tells the tale in his new book, If You Repeat It, I Will Deny. released in March by the publisher Plomb. Oddly, mainstream media are ignoring this alarming revelation that Bush may have been half-cracked when he started his Iraq war. My own paper, the Charleston Gazette in West Virginia, is the only U.S. newspaper to report it so far. Canada's Toronto Star recounted the story, calling it a stranger-than-fiction disclosure, which suggests that apoplectic fervor may have held sway within the walls of the White House. Apocalyptic fervor may have held sway within the walls of the White House. Fortunately, online commentary sites are spreading the news, filling the press void. The French revelation jives with other known aspects of Bush's renowned evangelical certitude. For example, a few months after his phone call to Chirac, Bush attended a 2003 summit in Egypt. The Palestinian foreign minister later said the American president told him he was, quote, on a mission from God, quote, close quote, to defeat Iraq. At that time, the White House called this claim absurd. Recently, GQ magazine revealed that former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld attached warlike biblical verses and Iraq battle photos to war reports he hand-delivered to Bush. One declared, quote, put on the full armor of God so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, close quote. It's awkward to say openly, but now departed President Bush is a religious crackpot, an ex-drunk of small intellect who got saved. He never should have been entrusted with the power to start wars. For 6 years, Americans really haven't known why he launched the unnecessary Iraq attack. Official pretext turns out to be baseless. Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, after all, and wasn't in league with terrorists, as the White House alleged. Collapse of his asserted reasons led to speculation about hidden motives. Was the invasion loosed to gain control of Iraq's oil, or to protect Israel, or to complete Bush's father's vendetta against the late dictator Saddam Hussein? Nobody ever found an answer. Now, added to the other suspicions, comes the goofy possibility that abstruse, supernatural, idiotic, laughable biblical prophecies were a factor. This casts an ominous pall over the needless war that has killed more than 4,000 young Americans and cost U.S. taxpayers perhaps $1 trillion. Needless to say, it also cost the Iraqi people incredible suffering. All right, my commentary for today, August 12th. This item is out of Munich, Germany. Gino Massetti was only 15 when Nazi troops rounded him up with 10 other Italian civilians and forced them into a barn in Tuscany before blowing it up. A massacre carried out in revenge after partisans killed two soldiers. Though Massetti, the lone survivor, couldn't identify who ordered the slaughter, former Wehrmacht Lieutenant Joseph Schlingaber was convicted Tuesday of murder based on circumstantial evidence that put him at the scene as the ranking officer. He was sentenced to life in prison. Though witnesses in such cases are rare and memories have faded over more than six decades since World War II, experts say the case underscores that it is still possible to win a conviction against Nazi war criminals. Quote, even old age cannot protect one from prosecution. This by Norbert Frey, a historian at the Friedrich Schiller University in Jena. I wonder if Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Eric Prince, and his merry band of Black Hawk mercenary contractors have heard this news. It seems that at least in Germany, it's never too late to punish war criminals. Next item. Are chemtrails real? People in Mount Shasta think so, and they've been battling their local government for years now to do something. Here's a letter from a Mount Shasta listener. Hello, all. Note that for 2 days before that bad lightning storm we had August 1st, we had a sudden upsurge in aluminum contrail activity. It had been low for weeks. We're fairly certain that aluminum dust causes superconductivity of the air, and we thus get fierce storms like that one. Maybe the military ought to pay for the fires they caused by that spraying. A friend of mine out of Shasta County watched closely the next day as a many-acre fire started on a hilltop range right below his house. It took a lot of effort and risking of firefighters' lives to put it out. This mad science program will stop when the majority of Americans have the courage to stand up and say we will not tolerate this assault upon our health and environment any longer. Next item. In case anyone still harbors the delusion that things have changed in Washington, D.C. now that Obama is the figurehead, this next article may interest you. Sybil Edmonds requests Attorney General review the invocation of state secrets privilege. Edmonds to testify in Ohio case unless Attorney General reinvokes the privilege. Washington, D.C. Attorneys for FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds have requested that Attorney General Holder review the state secrets privilege invoked in her case and reverse the decision made under former President Bush. Ms. Edmonds was illegally fired from the FBI due to her protected disclosures. An independent investigation by the Department of Justice Office of Inspector General confirmed the serious misconduct committed by the FBI and the illegality of her termination. On or about October 18, 2002, the previous administration invoked the state secrets privilege in order to have Ms. Edmonds' whistleblower First Amendment claims dismissed and to protect the government from embarrassment. Ms. Edmonds has now been requested to provide sworn deposition and affidavit testimony in a case pending before the Ohio Elections Commission. This case raises national significant issues of electoral fraud and violation of law. The state secrets privilege has stifled Ms. Edmonds for the past 7 years, and this deposition will be the first time that she will put her knowledge on the record. Given the pendency of this case and the request for her testimony, the National Whistleblowers League Defense and Education Fund requested that the Attorney General immediately and independently review the basis upon which the privilege was initially invoked and formally and in writing withdraw that privilege. At the time of this release, two separate deadlines for the Department of Justice to respond to the attorney's letter had passed, and consequently the deposition has been scheduled for Saturday. Although a request was hand-delivered to the Department of Justice, the Attorney General's office informed counsel that they were having difficulty in locating it. According to Stephen M. Kahn, the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center and one of Ms. Edmonds' attorneys, quote, "The Obama administration must take a fresh look at how the state secrets privilege was improperly used to hide government misconduct from the public view." Ms. Edwards has been requested to provide testimony in court. She will do so unless the government again invokes the privilege to quash her First Amendment rights. Ms. Edmonds' deposition was scheduled for last Saturday, August 8th. The event was open to the press. So, by the time I read this on air, that deposition and press conference will have already taken place. Have you heard about it from corporate media news? I'm sure they featured it. Maybe you just weren't paying attention. Next item from the Huffington Post, San Jose, Costa Rica. Nobel Prize laureate and Costa Rican President Oscar Arias said Tuesday that he has the swine flu, showing that not even a head of state is safe from the virus that has caused worldwide concern, but relatively few deaths. The 69-year-old president said in a statement that he was quarantined at home and is being treated with the anti-flu medicine oseltamivir. "The pandemic makes no distinctions," Arias said. "I'm one more case in this country, and I'm being submitted to the recommendation that health authorities have established for the entire population." Read into that what you will. Next item. I consider health care reform to be the most important issue facing our nation today. If you honestly examine your daily lives and the choices you make, it should be clear that the real danger facing you is the fragility of your own health. And the true terrorists threatening you and your family are not Islamic fanatics, but the corporations who have a stranglehold on American health care. The terrorists you should be battling are the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and HMOs. So this week's show will be devoted primarily to the supposed health care reforms Congress is pretending to address. We begin with a commentary from my favorite website, Astrologer. My position point on health care is crystal clear. Why are we allowing corporations to profit off of our illnesses? Why can they profit by denying us care? Take the profit out of the system, or at least put it in something that encourages the profit to be reduced via competition. The healthcare companies need a bit of competition, and I mean healthy competition, such as public option. People don't have to sign up for it. They should automatically get it. The fire department comes to put out their fire. The police respond when they call. Their children can get an education as a member of society. Why wouldn't healthcare be part of that package of benefits of being a member of this society? For example, if we had universal health care, we wouldn't have to have such exorbitantly priced malpractice insurance. The health needs and care of any injured person would be covered for life. Think of the cost savings. That alone, No huge malpractice insurance fees. No fear of litigation on the doctor's part. No lawyers suing and profiting would reduce the costs in the system. One health insurance company executive was paid $1,700,000 in annual salary. That is 8,500,000 mammograms at $200 apiece. One guy's work for 1 year is worth 8.5 million mammograms? Please. Do you see why the healthcare industry is fighting these changes so vigorously? That was from an astrological website. This next article is by Erica Werner, Associated Press writer, and it's called House Democrats Push Ahead on Compromise Health Bill. Washington, D.C. House Democrats methodically pushed ahead with a compromise health overhaul Thursday over liberals' complaints, intent on achieving tangible, if modest, success on President Barack Obama's top domestic priority, ahead of a month-long summer recess. We've got to pass the bill. Not only do we have to, but we're going to, this said by Representative Henry Waxman of California, chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, the last of three House committees to act on the sweeping legislation. Across the Capitol, there was more delay as bipartisan Senate negotiators announced they needed additional time to produce any agreement for their committee to review. Senator Max Baucus of Montana, chairman of the Finance Committee, said it would be September before the panel could act. He spoke after a day of uncertainty in which months of negotiations briefly appeared to veer off course. Quote, "The President, Leader Harry Reid, and I share the goal of bipartisan bill, and we will continue to work towards meaningful bipartisan legislation that can pass the Senate and become law this year," Baucus said in a statement. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, the lead Republican in the talks, said earlier that the discussions have made very good progress and may result in a deal. Quote, "But that'll never happen if Democratic leaders tell Republicans to take a hike by forcing the committee to move on an all-Democrat bill," he said. Harry Reid told reporters during the day that August deadlines were a product of the media rather than lawmakers of the White House. Republicans swiftly produced a rebuttal in the form of statements from Obama as well as Reid, underscoring the importance of action by early August. Both chambers already jettisoned plans for floor votes before the summer break, and Democrats are now aiming just to get the bills out of the final House and Senate committees that have yet to act. Even that much has turned into protracted struggle, but Democratic leaders say it had to happen. Returning to their home districts with Obama's top issue in disarray on Capitol Hill was not an option. Waxman's committee resumed work Thursday with a goal of finishing Friday after a week and a half delay caused by objection from fiscally conservative Democrats. That rebellion was quelled with an agreement Wednesday that would protect more small businesses from a requirement to provide insurance to their employees and restructure a new public insurance plan so it could pay higher rates to doctors and other providers, amongst other changes. But the concessions Waxman made to the fiscally conservative Blue Dog Democrats infuriated House liberals. They denounced the proposed new structure of the government-run insurance option, which was originally designed to be based on Medicare rates. The new structure says rates would be negotiated with providers, as occurs now with private companies, which could result in more expensive care. Quote, "This agreement is not a step forward towards a good health care bill, but a large step backwards." This was said by 53 Progressive Caucus members, and they said that in a letter to House leaders. "Any bill that does not provide, at a minimum, for a public option with reimbursement rates based on Medicare rates, not negotiated rates, is unacceptable." Liberals threatened to vote against the bill if it comes to the floor without stronger public plan. Representative Anthony Weiner of New York, an Energy and Commerce member, said they probably had enough votes to block the Blue Dog deal in committee. Some details of the deal remain murky. As part of the agreement, the Blue Dogs are insisting they won't vote for a bill that costs more than $1 trillion over 10 years, but that would require Democrats to make more cuts or raise more money. It wasn't clear how much or how it would be accomplished. As Energy and Commerce lawmakers worked through stacks of Republican and Democratic amendments, Waxman's shaky majority was on display early when the committee voted 29-28 to defeat a Republican amendment to strengthen ID requirements designed to prevent illegal immigrants from getting Medicaid benefits. Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California expressed confidence the committee would approve the bill and said the full House would follow suit in the fall. She also signaled flexibility on key issues, saying that despite her own backing for abortion rights, she would not allow that issue, to torpedo legislation. According to the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, highlighting the frenetic activity the overhaul has spurned in Washington, health care interests have reported spending $262 million lobbying in the first 6 months of this year, more than any other portion of the economy. That was $23 million more than healthcare-related companies and groups spent lobbying during the first half of last year. The next article is entitled, Of Blue Dogs and Pink Jellyfish. It's by Dave Lindorf on SmirkingChimp.com. What's the difference between a blue dog Democrat and a progressive Democrat? One is a vertebrate with a spine and a willingness to bite. The other is a jellyfish with no spine and no teeth. This difference has been glaringly apparent in the current fight over health care reform. The blue dogs in House and Senate have been giving the progressive Democrats an object lesson in how a small group in Congress can get its way. They've threatened to withhold their support for the Obama administration's key policy objectives of a health care reform package, and have managed, with just a handful of votes between them, to remove almost all progressive content from that legislation by threatening to walk if they don't get their way. Compare that to the progressives, a much larger faction within the Democratic Party majority in both houses. There are plenty of articles currently circulating in the media talking about progressive rage and dissatisfaction, both amongst progressives at large and amongst progressives in Congress, over the bills that are emerging in committees both in the House and Senate. Bills that are gutting any reference to a genuine so-called public option, government insurance plan, that would actually compete with and challenge private insurance companies, and that have studiously avoided having anything to do with a single-payer approach. Bills that call for actually cutting back on Medicare, the wildly successful single-payer program that since 1965 has been providing health care for the elderly and the disabled. But none of the dissatisfied progressive Democrats in Congress, and only a few of the progressive political organizations operating outside of Congress, have threatened to bolt and oppose the sellout legislation that is being produced in Congress, or to stop supporting those Democrats in Congress who are caving in to the pressure from the health care industry lobbies. And certainly, none of these progressive groups have told the president that he will no longer have their support if he doesn't insist on a much bolder and progressive health reform bill. Given the power that the small blue dog Democratic caucus has demonstrated by threatening to rebel and vote against a health reform bill, just imagine the power that a progressive caucus would have if it were to collectively threaten a no vote. Just imagine the different path that health care reform legislation would be taking in Congress today if progressive organizations like trade unions, Netroots organizations, and others were to tell President Obama that they would withhold their backing in 2010 from any member of Congress who didn't vote for a single-payer plan, or that he could no longer count on their support in 2012 if he failed to push for single-payer today. This is the lesson of the current disaster of health reform in Congress, and it is just the latest chapter in the failed history of progressive Democratic politics. It's fine to work to elect progressives to Congress and to send a Democrat, progressive or not, to the White House, given that there's no chance for progressive change while Republicans are in charge, and given the institutional obstacles and the fratricidal internal conflicts that prevent the rise of a viable third party. But progressive voters and progressive organizations have forgotten the lessons of the civil rights and anti-Indochina war movements. That lesson is that elections are only a small first step, and that only mass movements operating outside of Washington and outside of electoral politics, mass movements that threaten the Democrats who are currently in power, can produce progressive change. The power of the blue dogs in Congress is derived from the fact that despite their small number, they're numerous enough that if they stick together, they can derail a progressive reform bill. But imagine how much more powerful the progressive caucus in Congress and the Senate would be if it took the same tack. Progressives in Congress, if they developed spines and teeth and ceased being jellyfish, could threaten to vote against every bill offered by those same blue dogs unless they supported real health care reform. That is, a single-payer plan such as the one being put forward today by Representative John Conyers of Michigan. If they were backed up by progressive grassroots organizations, that let it be known that support would end for any Democrat not backing single-payer reform, we could have that reform. Instead, we have jellyfish on the left, and both the president and the Democrats in Congress know that they can ignore the left because it will support them no matter what they do. That is not to say that all the Democrats in Congress are jellyfish, just most of them. Conyers, who showed jellyfish-like characteristics on the impeachment issue during the Bush-Cheney era, has been outspoken in his criticism of the Obama administration and has offered a real single-payer alternative. And last week, at a gathering of Progressive Democrats of America in Washington, Conyers warned that Obama risks being a one-term president, saying to him, "Buddy, you're wrong on health care and it's going to cost you big time." Nor is it to say that all progressive groups and individuals are towing the line and simply backing whatever Obama and the congressional Democrats offer. On July 30th, a major protest was mounted in Washington, D.C. by backers of the single-payer plan. Still, for the most part, progressives in Congress and at large across the country were quiet as Obama slimed single-payer and moved the debate to the right, only taking a stand at all on the already minimalist issue of whether there will be any kind of public option in the resulting legislation, however weak. And even there, few progressive members of Congress have actually voted to vote down such a lame measure if there's no public option or just a weak one. Note, there's still time to pressure the House for a vote to substitute Representative Conyers' single-payer plan for the sellout bill currently moving through the House. For information on how to join in the fight for single-payer, go to www.afterdowningstreet.org or www.pnhp.org. The next article is reprinted from The Nation. It's by John Nichols. It's called Why Single-Payer Advocacy Matters Now More Than Ever. How should serious supporters of health care reform spend the month of August? Not by getting trapped in the narrow debate between party of no Republicans who favor no reform at all and blue dog Democrats whose reform is to make a bad system worse. And not by campaigning for buzzwords, public option, employer mandates on whatever President Obama or Speaker Pelosi happen to favor this week. There will be plenty of advertising and organizing to that end, including a $15 million expenditure by the AFL-CIO. Americans who want to tip the debate in the most progressive direction should take advantage of an opening provided at the last minute during negotiations to get a bill approved by the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And they should do so by advocating even more aggressively for single-payer health care. One of the many side deals that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California and Energy and Commerce Chair Henry Waxman of California had to cut to get the votes they needed for the compromise reform measure that was approved before the House broke for its August recess will allow a floor vote on real reform. Waxman sidetracked a move by New York Congressman Anthony Weiner to replace his proposal with a single-payer plan by agreeing with Pelosi's approval to schedule a vote by the full House on the plan to replace the current for-profit system with a Medicare-style plan that covers all Americans and controls costs. "A lot of members of our committee want to vote on that," Waxman said. He's worked closely with the Speaker to advance a moderate reform agenda. He said of single-payer, "I believe their wishes will be accommodated." Weiner is declaring a sort of victory, saying that single-payer is a better plan and now it's on center stage. Americans have a clear choice. Their member of Congress will have a simpler, less expensive, and smarter bill to choose. I'm thrilled that the Speaker is giving us that choice. Close quote. Of course, getting a September vote on single-payer does not mean that single-payer will get the votes. With the Obama administration and congressional leaders determined to compromise rather than fight, it's unlikely in the extreme. Okay. Of course, getting a September vote on single payer does not mean that single payer will get the votes. With the Obama administration and congressional leaders determined to compromise rather than fight, it's unlikely in the extreme that the current debate will end with the adoption of a single payer plan. Even if the House approved one, it would still face a fight in the Senate. But just as Republicans are willing to just say no to any reform, progressives should just say yes to real reform. Campaigning for single payer in August by demanding that members of the House agree to support such a plan when it comes up for a vote, and by urging senators to schedule and support a similar vote in their chamber, is the best way to assure that whatever reform ultimately comes will err on the side of Americans who need health care rather than on insurance companies that would deny them that care. At the very least, single-payer advocacy should preserve an amendment sponsored by Congressman Dennis Kucinich, which would allow states to experiment with single-payer programs even if the federal government refuses to do so. That's a significant matter, since Canada's national health care program began with single-payer experiments at the provincial level. The worst mistake that progressives could make in August would be to put their time and energy into getting members of Congress to agree to back a barely acceptable compromise that could end up being unacceptable by the time the lobbyists and their political handmaidens finish with it. Better to get representatives and senators to commit to back single-payer bills. That does not prevent them from ultimately agreeing to compromise measures, but it gets them to begin on the side of real reform and lessens the likelihood that the eventual deals will be as bad as the schemes that the Blue Dogs tried to impose before the break. Perhaps just as importantly, a strong vote for single payer will remind the Obama administration that the president was right when he said 6 years ago that single payer was the right response to the mess that private insurers and their allies have made of our health care system. Groups that back single payer are gearing up for August activism. Keep track of the most important advocacy on the healthcare issue by following the work of Physicians for a National Healthcare Program at www.pnhp.org, California Nurses Association, pdamerica.org. Activist David Swanson is suggesting that this should be single payer summer. Swanson's right. Only if Americans who favor real reform make this single-payer summer will we have anything worth considering in the fall. John Nichols, reprinted from The Nation. The time, 12:34 in the p.m., the place, the Nevada County Fair. The radio station's KVMR. The program is Rabble Rousing. Your host is Chamba Lane. This article is out of the San Francisco Chronicle. Police called on retirees at Senator's L.A. office. Police were called on a group of retirees who refused to leave Senator Dianne Feinstein's West Los Angeles office until she talked to them about health care reform. Los Angeles Police Sergeant Rich Brunson said Thursday that police lured the group of seven outside, then locked the building's doors behind them. Way to go, cops. A spokeswoman for the 55 to 87-year-old activists said they arrived at Feinstein's office around noon and remained in her conference room more than 6 hours. Feinstein's spokesman, Gil Duran, says staff offered the retirees an in-person meeting with the senator during a Los Angeles visit next week, but that they demanded to speak with her immediately. Then the article had a few comments. First one, it amazes me that there are still people out there who think Feinstein's give a blessed frock about anyone except her own self-interest. If these folks really want DiFi's undivided attention, they should hire a lobbyist who can throw around a lot of cash. Second comment, so what were they arrested for anyway, not leaving her conference room? Shameless to arrest senior citizens wanting to speak to their senator. Third comment, more power to them. I totally feel for these folks who are about to lose what they paid into. My comment. Well, at least some citizens are doing something about health care reform. How about the rest of you? As I said before, I consider the issue of single-payer health care to be the single most important issue of our times. Just imagine how your life and the lives of those you love would change if you never again had to worry about whether or not you could afford to pay for health care. Even if you are so wealthy that this is not a personal concern, imagine how the society around you would change if no one had to choose between paying for medication or food, or between health care or their mortgage. Now's the time. What are you going to do? Another article on health care insurance. Four questions to ask your senators and representatives. For years, candidates for Congress and elected members of Congress told you they needed to be elected and reelected so they could lower health insurance costs and provide universal coverage. Along the way, you kept working for and voting for these candidates and members of Congress until at long last, after the 2008 election, they formed wide majorities. Now, as that new wide majority drafts legislation designed to lower health care costs and provide universal coverage, you deserve to know if their campaign promises were real or just empty rhetoric. Will your senators support a meaningful public health insurance option, the minimum requirement to lowering health care costs and providing insurance to all Americans, or not? It's up to us to find out. Email your senators the following four short, specific questions on where they stand on a public option. Many members of Congress have given vague, open-ended answers when asked about their support for the public option. Many others have avoided those questions altogether. Some have even signed statements in support of a public option and then flip-flopped under pressure from corporate interests. We need to get to the bottom of this. No more vague answers. No more hiding behind process. No more talking a good game to progressive activists, but making deals with insurance companies behind closed doors. We need clear, written responses from every senator and congressperson on where they stand on the public option. As a citizen and as an activist, you are entitled to answers. If they don't respond, keep asking. If they respond to continue to be vague, keep asking. You elected this Congress. They answer to you. They might be able to dodge the media, but as a constituent, they have to give you answers. Email your senators and congresspeople the following four short, specific questions on where they stand on a public option. Don't stop till you receive a clear, written response from them. Here's the questions. Dear Senator or Congressperson, as a constituent, I have a few questions I'd like you to answer. I'm looking for specific answers to these questions so I can clearly understand your position. One, do you support a public health care option as part of health care reform? Two, if so, do you support a public health care option that is available on day one? Three, do you support a public health care option that is national, available everywhere, and accountable to our government? Four, do you support a public health care option that has the clout to establish rates to provide competitive with providers and big drug companies? As a constituent, I would really like to know the answers to these questions. Please respond in writing via email. Thank you. So that is something you can do at a minimum. Okay, the next article is by Charlie Reese. He's been a journalist for 49 years. This is reprinted from the American Free Press. He begins by stating that every citizen needs to read this and think about what this journalist has scripted in this message. Read it and then really think about our current political debacle. By Charlie Reese. Politicians are the only people in the world who create problems and then campaign against them. Have you ever wondered, if both the Democrat and the Republicans are against deficits, why do we have deficits? Have you ever wondered, if all the politicians are against inflation and high taxes, why do we have inflation and high taxes? You and I don't propose a federal budget. The president does. You and I don't have the constitutional authority to vote on appropriations. The House of Representatives does. You and I don't write the tax code. Congress does. You and I don't set fiscal policy. Congress does. You and I don't control monetary policy. The Federal Reserve Bank does. 100 senators, 435 congressmen, one president, and 9 Supreme Court justices equate to 545 human beings out of the 300 million Americans. And these 545 are directly, legally, morally, and individually responsible for the domestic problems that plague this country. I exclude the members of the Federal Reserve Board because that problem was created by the Congress. In 1913, Congress delegated its constitutional duty to provide a sound currency to a federally chartered but private central bank. I exclude all the special interests and lobbyists for a sound reason. They have no legal authority. They have no ability to coerce a senator, a congressman, or a president to do one cotton-picking thing. I don't care if they offered a politician $1 million in cash. The politician has the power to accept or reject it. No matter what the lobbyist promises, it's the legislator's responsibility to determine how he or she votes. Those 545 human beings spend much of their energy convincing you that what they did is not their fault. They cooperate in this common con, regardless of party. What separates a politician from a normal human being is an excessive amount of gall. No normal human being would have the gall of a speaker who stood up and criticized the president for creating deficits. The president can only propose a budget. He can't force the Congress to accept it. The Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land, gives sole responsibility to the House of Representatives for originating and approving appropriations and taxes. Who's the Speaker of the House? Nancy Pelosi. She's the leader of the majority party. She and fellow House members, not the president, can approve any budget they want. If the president vetoes it, they can pass it over his veto if they agree to. It seems inconceivable to me that a nation of 300 million cannot replace 545 people who stand convicted by present facts of incompetence and irresponsibility. I can't think of a single domestic problem that is not traceable directly to those 545 people. When you fully grasp the plain truth that 545 people exercise the power of the federal government, then it must follow that what exists is what they want to exist. If the tax code is unfair, it's because they want it unfair. If the budget's in the red, it's because they want it in the red. If the Army and Marines are in Iraq, it's because they want them in Iraq. If they don't receive Social Security but are on an elite retirement plan not available to the people, it's because they want it that way. There are no insoluble government problems. Do not let these 545 people shift the blame to bureaucrats, whom they hire and whose jobs they can abolish, or to lobbyists, whose gifts and advice they can reject, or to regulators, to whom they gave the power to regulate and from whom they can take this power. Above all, do not let them con you into the belief that there exist disembodied mystical forces like, quote, the economy, inflation, or politics that prevent them from doing what they take an oath to do. Those 545 people and they alone are responsible. They and they alone have the power. They and they alone should be held accountable by the people who are their bosses, provided the voters have the gumption to manage their own employees. We should vote all of them out of office and clean up their mess. Charlie Reese is a former columnist of the Orlando Sentinel newspaper. What you do with this article, now that you've heard it, it's up to you. And then they end by saying, here's a partial list of taxes you might have to pay. They might be euphemistically called licenses, fees, permits, but nonetheless, they're taxes upon we the people by our various governments. I'll give you part of the list. Inheritance tax, accounts receivable tax, building permit tax, California driver's license tax, cigarette tax, corporate income tax, dog license tax, excise taxes, federal income tax, federal unemployment tax, fishing license tax, food license tax, fuel permit tax, gasoline tax, gross receipt tax, hunting license tax, inheritance tax, inventory tax, IRS interest charges, IRS penalties, which is a tax on top of a tax, liquor tax, luxury taxes, marriage license tax, Medicare tax, personal property tax, real estate tax, service charge tax, Social Security tax, road usage tax, sales tax, recreational vehicle tax, school tax, state unemployment tax, telephone federal excise tax, telephone federal universal service tax, telephone federal, state, and local surcharge taxes, telephone minimum usage surcharge tax, telephone recurring and non-reoccurring charges tax, telephone state and local tax, telephone usage charge tax, utility taxes, vehicle license registration tax, vehicle sales tax, watercraft registration tax, well permit tax, workers' compensation tax. Now here's the kicker. Not one of these taxes existed 100 years ago, and our nation was the most prosperous in the world. We had absolutely no national debt. We had the largest middle class in the world, and mom stayed home to raise the kids. What the hell happened? Can you spell politicians? Charlie Reese. The next is an article by somebody that's usually fun to read, Greg Palast. He's writing for the Huffington Post. He calls it the day the president turned black. But has he turned back? He's in hot water now. For a moment, on national television, the president of the United States turned black. Last week, when his buddy Skip Gates got busted for being black in Boston, Barack Obama forgot his official role to soothe America's conscience with a happy fairy tale that his election marked the end of racism in the United States. Instead, Obama, the excruciatingly middle-of-the-road president, was seized by Barack, the militant state senator from the south side of Chicago, who reminded us that cops bust black guys for no goddamn good reason all the goddamn time. I'm reminded that it was not so long ago when we watched the vicious gang beating by Los Angeles cops of a defenseless handcuffed Rodney King, an African American. King's beating was unusual, only that it was caught on videotape. Yeah, I know. We've come a hell of a long way. Obama won. Jesse cried. Beyonce has her own line of perfume, and Tiger Woods plays where 30 years ago he couldn't even eat lunch. Good on him. But what about Robert Pratt, Mr. President? Pratt's a United Auto Worker member, has five kids and a mortgage payment of $1,100 a month and a house in Detroit worth no more than 40 grand. The payment's astronomical because he pays 11% on his mortgage balance, double the national average interest rate. Now, in those crazy terms, he's sure to lose his house. How did that happen? Pratt, whose story we've been tracking, was steered into a subprime loan by Countrywide Financial. Steering is the polite term for forcing folk into crappy loan terms. And not just any folk. Black folk, like Pratt. Over 60% of African-American mortgage applicants were and are steered into subprime predatory loans. According to exhaustive studies by the Federal Reserve Board and the Center for Responsible Lending, African-Americans are 250% more likely to get a loan with an exploding interest clause than white borrowers. And notably, the higher the income and the better the credit rating of a black borrower, the more likely the discrimination. As an economist, I can tell you it's not a stretch to say that Obama's failure to deal with endemic racism in the financial system is killing off hope of the nation's economic recovery. The exploding rate attack, centered on black and Hispanic communities, has, according to the CLR, caused over 40 million homes to lose value due to their proximity to foreclosed properties. Yet not a peep from the Obama administration about ending this Ku Klux lending practice, which has laid waste black communities and taken a hunk of white America's housing values with it. Instead, Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, is the honored guest of the board of directors of J.P. Morgan, owner of one of the most outrageous of the financial predators, Washington Mutual. Morgan, Washington Mutual, with its racially poisoned mortgage trickery, makes the Cambridge Police Department look like the NAACP. Indeed, Emanuel's host, J.P. Morgan, was sued last week by the NAACP for systematic, institutionalized racism in making home mortgage loans. The cold truth is, financial attacks on the black community continue as freely under Obama as under Bush, despite Obama's power to haul it instantly by banning loan sharking as a condition of continued bailouts for these banks. Obama has directed the FDIC to guarantee J.P. Morgan loans, saving the bank $3.1 billion this year. Obama has directed the FDIC to guarantee Mr. Pratt hope. And what about Thomas Johnson, Mr. President? Johnson, a minister in Florida who lost his vote in 2000 alongside at least 94,000 others falsely accused of being felons without the right to vote. Most of the innocents accused and abused were black, the minister included. I know because I saw those state records with a carefully recorded BLA next to the voters' names. I had an editor on the story, I won't say his name because he was so typical, who asked me why Johnson, an African American, didn't pound the table and demand his ballot. Johnson's no Harvard professor in Boston with a president's phone number on his speed dial. My extremely white editor, a Yale graduate sitting in San Francisco, could not imagine what would happen if a dark-skinned Reverend Johnson had started making a scene in Alachua County in the deep, deep south. The Reverend was smart not to pull a Skippy Gates and lip off at authority. Just a couple of months ago, Alachua cops tased an angry but unarmed black man, then shot him dead with 7 bullets. Johnson's vote loss, you might say, was so 2000. This is post-racial 2009. B.S. In last year's election, Florida went right back to the racially biased block and purge of black voters, barring thousands from the ballots through new ID laws that would have made Jim Crow segregationists of the 50s proud. Yet the Obama administration appears quite squeamish about taking down the Nouveau ballot box, Bull Connors. What I'm saying is that the venom of structural racism in America continues to sicken us all, in our economy, in our voting stations, in our schools, our health care system, you name it. Yeah, I joined the Hope Parade and voted for Obama, expecting just this one change, a direct attack on the remaining areas of official sanction of racist policies and practices. I'm still waiting. It was quite inspiring last Thursday to see a black man appear, if momentarily, behind the presidential seal. Unfortunately, Obama's swift demand for equal justice under the law was provoked only when the whip came down on someone like himself, whose professional and class status had, they presumed, made them exempt from the daily insults and assaults visited on their less privileged brothers. So much was made of Gates Harvard's post that the issue seemed to be, it's not right to cuff a dark-skinned man who's a Harvard professor. The race-neutral rules of class privilege have been violated. What's missing in America and in the Oval Office is any hint of outrage at the endemic, systematic cruelties visited on black Americans like Pratt and Johnson, who lack a key to the Harvard Alumni Club. Okay, let's go out with an article from the San Francisco Gate columnist Mark Morford. Marijuana, gateway drug to Jesus. Does pot lead to total enlightenment, rehab, Scientology? Let's find out. Behold, I believe I found it, a flawless specimen, a place where all collides and coheres and comes together in a madcap, slapdash, whirlwind, hellstorm of entirely bogus hype and spin and half-truths, intermixed with hope and despair and Jesus and not just a little bit of methadone. All of it so wonderful and confusing it makes you want to shut it all down, run a hot bath, light up a joint, and chill the hell out. It's all here. I even took a screenshot of it just to show you. Two, actually. I'll link to them in a moment because I really, really want you to see the whole truth and all its profound glory. Ready? The first comes in form of a big study from University of Pittsburgh, 12 years in the making, that valiantly attempts to answer with some reasonable authority the questions that's already been answered pretty definitively by 500 million pot smokers throughout world history, and also by every ounce of common sense and every commonsensical human alive today. But who cares about that now? Here's the big question. Is marijuana a gateway drug to harder, more dangerous, and deadly substances later in life? Did a bunch of kids who smoked pot in their teens go on to become addicts and criminals and libertarians? Did they ruin their lives via meth and coke and sundry other delicious demons in anything resembling dangerous or enlightening percentages? Enough that we could finally declare, once and for all, that pot really does lead to destruction and not, as so widely presumed, merely to kinky sex and fits of uncontrollable laughter and the consumption of rather nauseating food combinations you would never entertain otherwise? You already know the answer. Marijuana, it turns out for the billionth time, is not a gateway drug at all, not even a little. Which is not to say excessive pot use throughout one's life is not a gateway to becoming, say, a bit of a slothful and lumpish fan of unwashed dreadlocks and reggae festivals and bad pizza. But that's a different study. But that's not the fun part. The fun part is what you can see right there on the Science blog page. Here's a link to the first screenshot where I read the article in question. Look over there just to the left, where the kindly Google AdSense system automatically places related goodies that it scientifically calculates you, the troubled, sinful, pot-smoking reader, might be deeply interested in, given your sinful, illegal predilections. Hey, look there. It's an ad for not one, but two drug rehab centers near you. Isn't that thoughtful? And below that, a lovely ad for online Bible study. Whoa, thanks, Google. You sure as hell nailed my needs. Let me see if I've got it right so far. Pot is not the slightest bit dangerous, really. But if you're reading this, there's a hugely expensive, almost totally ineffectual rehab clinic anyway. And if you missed that one, here's another one. And by the way, you could probably use more Jesus in your life, because if you're interested in pot, you're clearly a lost and wayward loser, or your husband's sister child is, and what kid doesn't need lots and lots of expensive rehab and Jesus? But that's not even the best part. The best part is right there in the middle of the article. See it? The scary-looking ad about getting the facts about pot with the word marijuana nicely blasted into some hairy horror movie font, all sponsored by a group called the Foundation for a Drug-Free World. Hey, Foundation 97 called. It wants its corny... No, Foundation 1977 called. It wants its corny alarmism back. Let us now click on that scary ad. Whoosh, we're being whisked straight over to a wacky, expensive multimedia site from the Drug-Free World people. And then he shows you screenshot 2, full of video clips and anti-drug propaganda brochures and studies and educational info, some of it featuring real people telling their stories of drug-induced horror and of selling their wife into slavery to score another gin and tonic. Awful. The kicker. The link actually launches right into a video clip about pot, where the hunky stone teen intones the killer line of all. They said marijuana was a gateway drug. Puff, swoon, snort. They lied. Isn't that great? Right in the middle of a scientific article saying pot is not a gateway drug, an ad says they're lying and pot totally is a gateway drug because, well, it just is. And who, pray tell, is the Foundation for a Drug-Free World? Why, look, 15 seconds of searching. Dear God, is there anything Google can't do? Reveal it's none other than those wacky Scientologists. What a shock. By the way, I absolutely adore the unicorns and bunnies utopia implied in the phrase a drug-free world. Sort of like saying a dust-free desert or a salt-free ocean or an adultery-free Republican Party. It's likely they let an over-sheltered child come up with their name. Partnership for no more icky things like ever. And lo, we come full circle, swinging wide and full through a multimedia maelstrom of mixed messages, anti-drug PR, BS, and funhouse misinformation, where tentative science collides with alarmist rhetoric, rubs against your sad need to give yourself over to blind religious faith so you don't have to think too much, ever again. All of it smashing headlong into professionally produced dour propaganda funded by one of the weirdest and most litigious religions in the known universe, the founder of which was rumored and alleged to be quite a drug user all by his own self. Neat. Hey, check it out. I'm reading about the scientifically proven non-dangers of marijuana. I shall soon enter drug rehab and study the Bible and join the cult of Scientology so I can, if their videos are to be believed, stop going to the beach on warm, lazy summer days with my friends and lighting up a bong as hot, skinny girls squirm around.